In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
Madam Speaker. Madam Vice President.
You want to hang out with us? You can get your vaccine.
And so I went to Human Resources.
There's some things I just can't tell you on air.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
A woman's problem, if you will.
Hello, hello. I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
And I'm Millie Tamirez.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. We were just catching up before we got on the mic about the long-awaited Betches Pups initial union over the weekend. So Tino and Rusty, what did they talk about? What were the biggest topics in dog news and politics over the weekend?
Oh, well, they have a lot of thoughts about the Adams administration. Yeah, well, Tino is a leftist.
Tino feels like we need, you know, landlord reform.
Valentino
is a leftist, absolutely. And yeah, no, they were just talking about the Adams administration. You know how much better Cynthia Nixon would have been for governor, but terrible as Miranda. Stuff like that, you know?
You know, the thing with Rusty that's interesting is he is from Ohio. So sometimes he's like, you know, he's doing a lot of relearning. And I think, and Tino has been so gracious in his like educating of Rusty, because Rusty really, he is coming at things with an open heart, but like his background, he hasn't been exposed to a lot of different ideas. He is Amish.
Right.
And so it's really amazing for him to have this strong Latino man in his life to teach him about different different types of dogs and how to live in the city. And
the vaccines are safe. I heard we finally overcame some vaccine hesitancy, and now
Rusty was a little bit of an anti-vaxxer. I will say that although Tino, the website said it was from an Amish place, definitely the people that Tino came from were Mayor of Easttown.
Mayor of Easttown genre.
Genre Caucasian people. And but that just made his relationship to populism even more stronger. And you know what? He has the patience, Tino, to explain and have the open heart necessary to have transformative politics. So it was a great dialogue.
I love that.
It was great.
It sounds like this will be an ongoing dialogue. And
no,
next time,
sure.
You know, when Morty is, he's a little older, but when he's feeling up to it, as you know, he has a lot of special needs. Not always a good day for Morty, but you know, when he's feeling good, he can come and confer some more wisdom on the little pups.
That's so true, because we need an adult kind of grounding force, because I do think that Rusty and Tino together, they get very radical, and not that I don't believe in that, but it's like we do need kind of someone who can look forward and say, you know, as an older dog.
I think what he would say is he's going to come over and he's going to say, you know what, as an older dog, you can still pee out inside, and he'll show them. Fuck these bitches. You know what? They deal with the patriarchy all the time. You can do whatever you want to them. They will clean up after you. So to start today, big morning. Just as we started recording, the website finally dropped. New healthcare website dropped, which can... that can go a number of ways, but 22 months into the coronavirus pandemic, the existing presidential administration has set up a website to send free test kits to all Americans. Did you guys check it out?
It works. I have not checked it out.
It works.
Well,
I didn't immediately get a test. They didn't like drone. I think they're going out later this month, but it was, at first I clicked on it, it did not. And then I was like snarky to somebody. I was like, it doesn't work. And they're like, it totally worked for me. I just put in an extra letter.
If you test positive in New York City, you can call this number and they'll send you a kit, and it has mask, gloves, a thermometer, an oximeter, and tests.
An oximeter, wow.
An oximeter and tests. Like, I got the Binax double test kit. So I'm like, wow, this would have been helpful March 2020. It would have been nice to get the end of this a year ago. But, you know,
yeah, listen, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So if you need a test, you can say you already have COVID and they will send you a test. But you know what? This is okay. But is it better late than never, Amanda? What do you think?
I think it's definitely better late than never. I mean, here's the thing. It's still quite a big undertaking. And as we say with this administration, compared to the last one, we have to recognize willingness to learn. Mm-hmm. And we have Jen Psaki literally on the mic saying that the idea, not saying, but sort of reacting to the idea of sending all Americans test kits as if that was silly. And then here, weeks later, after a surge and a really strong reaction from the public, we have this website that is like basically socialized medicine that works and you can get 4 tests a month. So I definitely think better late than never. And, you know, there's going to be more probably variants. And frankly, there's going to be, I mean, another pandemic probably. So like we had to figure out how to do this now. Like we can't just keep waiting for the virus to become more mild and then go away, because eventually there will be a variant that's stronger or there will be a new disease. So like the fact that they have shown we know how to do this now makes me feel personally reassured as like a person living in a country where this could happen again and keep happening.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is good to just know, like, obviously it would have been great to have had this website any moment before now, but we have it now. And what's great is that whatever infrastructure they have now built exists to send, have Americans request and receive medical stuff. So
totally,
you know, it's at the end of the day, even if this website, like whatever, like we, you know, the pandemic ends, we don't need to request tests anymore. Whatever the infrastructure was built to create this website, I think is going to be really, really useful going forward. And it didn't crash like healthcare.gov.
Right.
And, you know, my socialist coming, like, I'm kidding, but it is interesting, like you're saying, the government has this, somebody has to be packing these boxes, somebody you know, they need workers to do that. Can America have their own Amazon? This is where I'm going. This is where my brain is going.
Oh.
Is
like,
because listen, these workers packing these boxes, they're being able to use the, they got to use the bathroom. They're using the bathroom. They're having lunch breaks.
I think you just socialismed so hard you did a capitalism by saying, can we employ so many people in America that we basically make an Amazon?
Or can we have a government-based Amazon that's more ethical, that has like stronger minimum wage, that isn't abusing workers? That
space gives technology.
Who knows?
And it sends you like, it doesn't send you just like kind of random like shit that you thought of to buy at like 2 o'clock in the morning. It sends you like important things that every American needs for their life.
No, I love this. I love the idea of being able to like get a little medical goodie bag from the government every month. And so how long is this going to last? I mean, right now it seems like you can get 4 at once, I assume, like as supplies last and can be replenished. And I know the government recently bought like 500 million kits, which is not a lot when you think of how often people are testing. And there are 330 million Americans. But then I remembered that only about 50% of us are taking it seriously and testing really regularly. So that it's not like, yes, every American can get a test. Like, will they get a test? Probably not. I mean, I just imagine some of those health insurance executives, like, probably a little bit relieved at all of the anti-vax, like, all of the anti-testing sentiment, because they're not going to have to pay for those people's tests.
Yeah. They're funding Macedonian.
They're the ones putting those Facebook ads up saying, don't get tested.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally, I mean, we say that, but, like, I wouldn't even be surprised if some documents come out when we're, like, 50 that are like, no, that's actually true.
Listen, everything I say, I don't know about y'all, everything I say is 100% serious. On this podcast.
We know.
No, but it is an interesting thing, like y'all are saying, looking to the future. This is, they're looking at this virus becoming endemic and not a pandemic, but just something that we live with, like the flu, like the cold, especially if you're vaccinated. So yeah, how can we, you know, even though it's like a flu, like a cold, you still have to isolate. So people still need to know if they have it. Yeah.
Do you guys know how, like, when you're watching a show you watch all the time or something, that, like, you can tell when an actor in it, like, is getting over a cold or something. You can tell when they're in a little nasally. That, watching those in the COVID era is so jarring and traumatizing, because you're like, why are you there? Hearing a sick person, like, we can never hear a sick person like we used to. Like, we used to be at work and be like, oh, I shouldn't sick. Shake your hand. I have a little cold. Never again. Never again. Like, now, can you imagine if somebody went up to you and said, I'm not going to shake your hand, I'm feeling a little sick. We would all say, sir, because it's a guy, sir, go home. The fuck are you doing here?
I mean, literally, like, if I'm, like, out and I know that, I don't know, like, over the summer, like, I'm having allergies, or, like, if I just have a headache, whatever, any non-COVID related thing, I, like, will, if I'm in public, I will, like, whisper and be like, today I sneezed. Because I don't want people to, like, think I have COVID.
Yeah. Like, well, just
precisely.
Like a culture shock when I, you know, in a former life, I was a businesswoman that would go to Japan a lot, to the head office in Japan a few times. And you would just see people, like, most of the people are not wearing masks, but some randomly somebody has a mask. And I'm like, oh no, why are you wearing masks? That's so silly. And they're like, oh, you know, I'm feeling a little under the weather. I'm still here, but I'm feeling a little under weather and I don't want to spread it. And I'm like, that's weird. But now I'm like, man,
yep.
Wear a mask in the office if you have to go, but also stay home.
Yeah. I mean, they're still trying to figure out exactly why the virus has been so, like, weird in Japan. Like, just compared to everyone else, they are doing amazing. They have had not nearly as many, like, hospitalizations and death in ways that just don't make sense given the way, like, it has worked out in, like, China and Korea and other, like, neighboring countries. But, like, Vietnam has also done amazing. But they think that the part that, like, just wearing masks was no big deal, that when this started, it wasn't, like, I mean, remember us, we were like, should we wear a mask? That seems so dramatic. And they told us not to, but it was just no big deal. So that's definitely here to stay as well. So
they didn't have an anti-masker movement. Yeah.
No, definitely not. Next story for today. We know that the financial impact of the pandemic has kind of been all over the place, but, like, overall negative, right? I think we can agree. Overall global net negative impact. The incomes of approximately 99% of people around the globe fell since March 2020. More than 160 million people have been forced into poverty. But don't worry, the world's 10 richest men, specifically 10 richest men, saw their fortunes grow by more than double, according to the group Oxfam. I didn't even know Oxfam came for billionaires, but I'm whatever, fine. I know what you might be thinking, Amanda, we know billionaires make a ton of money very fast. This is how it's always been. It's getting faster because that's how exponential growth works. Like, as long as we sort of sit around and talk about should we tax billionaires more, they're becoming even more billionary. So the wealth of the world's billionaires has increased more since COVID-19 began than it has in the last 14 years. That stat blew my mind. Those billionaires profited directly from the government money pumped into the markets to prop up the economy. So the money that the government gave people that they were able to spend, that helps these billionaires because, as we've discussed, like, it's the wealthy who benefit from these improvements since their wealth is concentrated in investments that become more valuable over time, but they aren't taxed over time. So if the 10 richest men, just some more stats, in the world were to lose 99% of their wealth, they would still be richer than 99% of the people on the planet. And basically, like, there's plenty of ways to spin it. If they were able to give up a little bit of their wealth, it would cause this. But the Oxfam, they're saying specifically, this can be rectified by taxes because, at least in the United States, the absence of taxable revenue makes it harder for us to provide fundamental services to people who don't have enough money to make billions in passive income from the stock market. They don't have enough money to go get food. So Oxfam, they state plainly that this system leads to inequality that is killing people, and a tax on the ultra rich would address it. Seems logical to me.
Well, as someone who recently used an app to buy one stock, I cannot abide this.
Not my capital gains.
What stock was it?
It was called Corporate Cannabis.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Wow. A sellout.
I thought as a joke, I bought an AMC and Nokia stock, and now I get emails about shareholder meetings, and I'm confused.
You made money off your AMC stock, though, didn't you?
Yeah, but I never sold it because, you know, I wanted the free popcorn. So now it's worth not that much. But back to this. You know, the thing is that Elizabeth Warren said this best, which she has incredible tax policy. People are like, oh, well, aren't billionaires allowed to, you know, make money and be rich? And it's just like, they use our roads. They benefit from having workers that are that get free public school education. If there's a fire in their factory, our firefighters are, you know what, you know, so it's not like they don't get to pay into that. And then what ends up happening is that these billionaires, when they don't pay their workers enough, like when somebody on Amazon is on food stamps, or when someone at Walmart needs Section 8 housing, we're actually paying for that, because that comes out of our collective taxes that they don't pay. What they do is they get tax deductible charities, but those charities aren't audited nearly enough. They spend it on whatever they want to spend it on, you know, not necessarily what we need as a collective society. So billionaires are terrible.
That's what's really frustrating too, when you see my favorite person, Elon Musk, always like getting salty on Twitter, being like, prove to me that if I paid taxes, it would be good. And it's like, what do you mean? And also, as many of these senators and representatives who have unfortunately had to get into sparring matches with him on Twitter, because that's the state of things in politics, they always point out is like, he has literally gotten pandemic relief. Like, his company has also gotten subsidies to build things. Like, he actually, it's not even just like talking what Millie was talking about, which is 100% true, of this, like, you use our roads, you use our fire departments. There is actual literal transfers of cash from the U.S. government to their companies in the form of subsidies, in the form of government contracts, in the form of this and that. So it really just shows like this relationship of only taking and never giving back.
And if you give back at all, it's nowhere near proportionate to what you're able to take, because obviously the average American is like living off of the money that's in their paycheck. We can't put all of our paycheck in the stock market, so that, like, we need our money because most of us don't make enough money to live. We need it to buy goods and services that we need to live, whereas they can just shove it all away.
Speak for yourself, Amanda. I'm a corporate cannabis business.
Well, as I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, think of a time in your life, the three of us, where you just felt like the most financially secure. If I can think of that place, I was like, this is good. I don't need anything else. Like, of course you do and you want it, but I would just be like, I don't know. I just don't want to take, like, how can you take that much take? I just can't imagine that, like, take, and not feeling, because with Bezos and Musk specifically, you know, they're challenged on this all the time and they can rationalize. They seem to have a very logical explanation that they tell themselves for why they shouldn't have to contribute more, and they're contributing plenty, but I don't know. I get my tax bill and I'm like, all right.
Well, also too, the thing is, I mean, and Donald Trump, like, whatever, but like, the thing is that, like, we don't tax billionaires and rich people enough. We don't tax them enough. And they have incredible lawyers that make sure that they get all these loopholes, or we don't have enough manpower, which is what, forgive me, Amanda, you can fact check me, and it wasn't in Build Back Better, like, to put more money in the IRS so that they can enforce and get more tax money back, because, like, we're not even getting the fucking minimum that they don't even pay the minimum that we're supposed to get, because, you know, they have all these loopholes and all this stuff. So it's not even that, like, oh, we need to pay more. It's like, they're not even paying what they should be paying. They have all these loopholes for it. Again, that was what was fascinating about Donald Trump with his tax shit, is that it was just insane. Mm-hmm.
It was all legal.
Loopholes and all
He paid $700.
Trump probably maybe broke some laws, but I know whenever you, like, whenever like those ProPublica stories,
Southern District of New York,
whenever like those ProPublica reports come out, they're always like, this is perfectly legal. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think next week we want to start looking at, like, what we should pull out of Build Back Better to make a really strong impact, and that one is huge. Like, the amount of money you have to put into the IRS versus how much you get back, it's like absolutely, absolutely worth it. So now we're going to discuss some follow-ups to the absolutely terrifying events out of Texas this weekend. We're also going to discuss an anti-Asian attack in New York. Both of these are probably triggering. So they're going to take up the rest of the episode. If we have time, we're going to come back to voting rights in about 20 minutes. So yesterday, I want to note, was a pre-recorded episode that we did with Josel Torres. So some people thought we ignored this story, but we just were off yesterday. So that's why it didn't come up. We are happy to address today.
And that was the plan. Yeah.
So we ran an episode that we recorded last week. Definitely listen to that. It was all about gerrymandering. But obviously, during Saturday services over the weekend, a man was welcomed into the Congregation Beth Israel Synagogue in Coleyville, Texas. Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker described how he let the man in and tried to talk to him and made him tea and noticed the man was behaving unusually. Then during a prayer, the rabbi said he heard a click and knew it could potentially be a gun. He describes thinking like it could have been anything, but I also knew it definitely could have been a gun. And it was. He was proven right. The one, I don't know if the word is fortunate thing, but a thing about what happened is that not a lot of people had attended this service in person because of the outbreaks that we're seeing right now. Certainly plenty, but a lot of people were watching via live stream, however, and they were the ones that called 911 because they saw that what was happening. The man was a British citizen. He held four people captive, including that rabbi, for more than 10 hours before they were able to successfully flee. He demanded the release of Afia Siddiqui, she's a Pakistani neuroscientist who's serving a sentence in a Texas federal prison. I believe what she did was she was being like interrogated related to something. And basically there was a standoff during that interrogation. She got her hands on a gun. And in that standoff, she was basically charged for trying to kill U.S. Army officers. And this suspect that is now dead the person that did it wanted her freed. He was 44. I mean, there are interviews with his brother who were like, I didn't even know he had the mental acuity to like leave Britain in a correct way, like with what was going on with him. The FBI were there, SWAT teams were there. I mean, everything was there. Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker shared with CBS this morning how he and the others ultimately escaped. This is just crazy. He said that in the last hour of the standoff, things were not going well. He said that the gunman was sounding and looking worse and worse, wasn't getting what he wanted, and was getting frustrated that he wasn't getting what he wanted. So, I mean, I keep saying that the hostages fled. I've seen it referred to as they were rescued. I've seen it referred to as they were released. I think they fled. They saved themselves. We saw the video. Citron Walker said that he waited for a moment when he felt like the gunman wasn't looking and was in a position where he couldn't get to them. And he looked at the people and he said, we're going to go. And he threw a chair at the gunman. And if you've seen the video, all three of them get out. There are no gunshots that you hear. The gunman like sort of follows them, but doesn't end up shooting at them. He looks really confused, but they saved themselves. They got out of there. The rabbi saved them. And the hostage taker died at the scene. It remains unclear whether he shot himself or was shot by law enforcement when we're recording this Tuesday at around 1. I can't believe that this story ended this way. And I hope the fact that it did end this way doesn't mean that we like forget about it too soon.
Yeah, it was really crazy to like watch the news coming in about it in the evening. And I remember I had gone to bed like kind of before the situation was resolved. So there was such a relief when I woke up in the morning, because that was like the first thing that I checked in the news to see that everyone had gotten out safely. But it's just really alarming. It's really scary to see houses of worship for any faith targeted at all. You know, this is multiple times in my life I can think of that we saw that. There was the church in South Carolina with Dylann Roof. I'm forgetting the name, but it's a historically black church. There was that one. There's the Christchurch massacre in New Zealand. There was the Tree of Life synagogue shooting. So it's like, I feel like now this is part of our world in the way that school shootings are. And like, I'm not going to put things on level, but it feels like an even more horrific escalation of our gun problem that like houses of worship are targeted.
Well, and it's also like, you know, people go to these places it's always sad to me because it's like, no matter what, you know, obviously there's an anti-Semitism issue that, you know, I know we're going to address later, but it's also like, it's always sad to me because the start of these situations are like they welcomed the gunman with open arms, like they wanted him. You know, these are places for community. Ultimately, no matter what the religion is, it's a place for community. And like these have been a hard few years for people, and people are looking for places to be safe, have community, and feel something and feel a higher purpose and higher connection. And it's just always sad and scary when these places are in danger or not safe like people thought they were, or that they're able to be these like places of insane tragedy. Like it's just so fucked up. Just like school should be this place that's safe, that people should learn and grow as human beings, and it's becoming this place where kids die in. It's like, you know, I mean, that just sucks. It's not cool. And like, obviously, you know, this man was mentally ill and felt, you know, an injustice. And it's just sad that he felt like the only way he could get justice is by, you know, doing this. It's just a really sad, difficult situation. But I'm glad, especially with, you know, other crime, like in the context of what's going on in this country, like, I'm glad that these people got away and like this ended just so lucky, because, you know, there's been situations in our news recently where, you know, cops end up shooting the wrong person, like on accident and all that, you know.
I mean, so 11 people died in Tree of Life. 11 people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, again, not to put a mass shooting is anything over, I believe, 4, it might be 5 people. So we're so used to hearing mass shootings and not, like, at least, like, not to put them up, but 11 people. And that's why, yeah, I said, like, I don't want the fact that this ended this way. I mean, Elise, you were saying yesterday that you even felt like it wasn't being characterized as a targeted anti-Semitic attack enough. And well, I think I agree with you.
Yeah, I think this something that was interesting was right after the attack, when the police were kind of doing their initial reports, I kept seeing this phrase when I was like getting ready to write for the newsletter that was like, his motives were not connected to the Jewish community. And it's like, okay, maybe that's true, like on paper, but clearly this is a mentally ill person who went into a synagogue and held people hostage. So even if to you, his motives don't seem connected to the Jewish community, clearly in his mind, they were connected to the Jewish community.
Right. Texas isn't like, Texas has a lot of people, so it has a lot more Jews than you might think. But it's not New Jersey or New York. It's not like you're driving by where we are all the time and you can say like, I'm feeling mad today, I'm going to go for those people. It's like you found where a synagogue was. You targeted a synagogue.
Yeah.
You target a place where Jews are that is anti-Semitic.
Yeah, and he didn't go to a government office for this, you know? He didn't go to somewhere.
Which would have made more sense.
Yeah, like, he didn't choose some sort of, like...
Well, I guess it's, like, just because somebody is mentally... Like, why are we so... Like, it's a problem that when you are deranged mentally, your mind goes to hating Jews. Like, that's a problem itself. So it's like, we can't just be like, oh, it was just... Because we'll talk about this next also with, like, the anti-Asian attack. People are like, I don't know if it was... You know, I've also heard that described as, well, that person, that killer went up to another person first and might have pushed them, and then he went up to the Asian woman. And it's like, well, we need to, if it's fine if, yeah, we're going to say mental illness and not all of it is like, I don't know if this guy, clearly this guy wasn't reading like QAnon conspiracy theories, but there's something wrong when people's first instinct when they are losing touch with reality is to target Jews.
Well, yeah, and attack a synagogue.
Yeah. And I mean, this is remnant of, to me, I mean, of the attack on the massage parlors last year, where it was all mostly Asian women. And then, you know, the cops were like, oh, it was just a bad day, or it had nothing to do with race, or it's not a hate crime. And it's just like, no, but like, yes, it is, you know? And then the exact
thing.
Why
did he think, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why did he think he was going to get away? You know? And like, it's just, and a lot of, yeah, it's just, that's when people do an attack, let's see what, you know.
You have to call it what it is.
Call it what it is, exactly.
Yeah, if only in the impact, because there's plenty of anti-Semitism to go around. I mean, Jewish people in America make up just 2% of the population, but 58% of recorded hate crimes are against us. And in 2020, hate crimes targeting Jews comprised almost 60% of all religious bias crimes. I just said that, but it's like it's been consistent year to year. The congregation, the rabbi says that he feels he was able to survive this because after that 2018 shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, he got training. His entire congregation got training, like really intense training for literally how to survive something like that and how to de-escalate. They've been ready for this because they knew these attacks were coming. And anti-Semitism is central to the QAnon conspiracy theory, which nobody is real. I mean, Trump last month said that evangelical Christians love Israel more than Jews in this country. So they're still fanning that flame. And I do think that like you said, Elise, it's like, even if this specific person's intent wasn't that he hated Jews, like there's going to be copycat crimes. We're normalizing going into places of worship and shooting them like we have school shootings. The kids doing school shootings now are doing it because they've seen it so much, because they want their names in the paper. What's to stop another anti-Semitic asshole or an asshole who just wants attention and wants his name in the picture or in the paper from going to a synagogue? Because that's like how you do it now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. I know a friend of mine in the before times, right before the before, he got married at a really famous synagogue in D.C., and I remember being kind of taken aback by the level of security and, like, metal detectors and stuff that were going in, and that was, like, back then because Tree of Life had happened, and they knew that they needed to be protected, and, you know, like, when you're talking about going into these sacred spaces, whether it be a synagogue or a church or a mosque or anywhere that someone's going to like pray and get themselves right, like to have to be reminded of violence as you're going in is so sad to me because I, you know, like people deserve to be able to like have the sanctity of that space, which is really terrifying. And to go to your point about QAnon, when I was writing the newsletter this morning, the FBI and DHS put out a letter yesterday basically being like, houses of worship should be on the lookout for this because our monitoring of domestic terrorist forums is just rife with really anti-Semitic stuff going on. I mean, they're like obviously tying Jewish people to COVID, to the 2020 election, to the situation in Afghanistan somehow. And DHS was like, we think that some of this is also fueled potentially by foreign actors, which is really scary. And then they rile these people up online and you get someone who's mentally ill, like this man, and he doesn't really understand what the connection is between why he thinks this, between this woman's imprisonment and Jews in his mind. But it doesn't matter if he understands it. What matters is that he brought a gun to a synagogue and held people hostage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are people that very much do understand that. And like you said, are trying to foment a lot of hate and violence based on it for yes, their own political gain. Like I said, thank God everybody got out of here. That was such a unlikely scenario. I mean, I encourage you to watch the CBS This Morning interview with the rabbi, frankly. He didn't look ready to be giving an interview. It's really heavy and really hard to watch. And also this weekend, a woman named Michelle Alisago was killed in New York after she was pushed in front of a subway car in Times Square. Michelle was Asian American. She was Chinese American. And this obviously adds to a series of anti-Asian attacks taking place in cities across the country. 8 months ago, 61-year-old Yao Pan Ma was also attacked in New York City, and he died of his injuries on New Year's. So he was very, very wounded for very long and sadly passed away. Michelle was a consultant. She was 40, as I said. She was living on the Upper West Side. She worked in Deloitte. She was very involved in her community, and she worked specifically with groups that helped the homeless. She was Chinese American, but police say there was no indication, as we said, that her death was a hate crime. They believe she was chosen at random. They say the person who killed her was an unhoused, mentally ill man who admitted to the crime and that he had approached someone else before her, which is what led them to believe that maybe this was not a racially motivated attack. But, you know, it's kind of similar to the story we just discussed. As long as people are targeting these groups, they remain targets, and it normalizes us as targets. And it just makes it's less of a barrier for the next mentally unhinged person to see an Asian person on the subway and push them. You know, like, I mean, I'm sure we all have friends that live in the city that are now spending money they don't have on cabs and Ubers because they're not getting on the subway. with this.
Well, pushed in front of the train is like the scariest subway. Like every New Yorker has thought about, like, what would I do if someone who was not well, like, tried to push me onto the tracks? And again, like, as we've been saying, you know, why maybe he targeted an Asian woman because he perceived her as weaker or had other, like we don't know what type of things play into why he would pick one person or another, you know what I mean? But it's like when we have so much racism, anti-Semitism, so much hate that's just swirling around in the culture, and then we have a mental health crisis and no help for anybody mm-hmm. who's going through it, mm-hmm. that racism is going to play out in ways that maybe don't even seem direct to us, mm-hmm. but it's still racism at its core.
Well, it's also, it's just, you know, this is a great example of a lot of issues in this country of, like, you know, unhoused, mentally ill people with no resources, like Elise says, unaddressed anti-Asian sentiment, and then also just infrastructure with, like, in other countries, they have little gates in front of the subway that prevent people from jumping. You know, like, we don't even have, like, it's just raw dog in the subway. Like, it's just
kind of crazy.
It's kind of crazy.
We do raw dog the subway.
There is a girl on TikTok who uses, have you seen this? She bike locks herself to the pole when she waits for the subway if she's by herself late at night. And that doesn't seem crazy to me.
Well,
there is, for anyone in New York, I don't know who designed, when you go from Union Square from the N to the L, but there is the tiniest little strip of, like, walking
between,
like you can't, if you are not a frequenter of the New York subway, let me tell you, it is crazy. It's the level of, like, not safety is going on down there.
I just know, even in the past, like, I don't know what, the past, like, 8 months are all of, since I think this has been more activated. I just know specifically my Asian American friends are like, I'm not taking the subway. I'm not doing that. Never.
Well, and it's just like, so it's like all these issues. And you know, I just wish that, or I hope that we use, not, you know, no one should die.
Well, her, the group that she worked with, and I think her community members, and the article I read said, this is an unbelievable tragedy. And it happened because there aren't enough resources and access to information and care. Mm-hmm. And you know, they didn't. And this is crazy because, you know, it was a New York Post article or like a Page Six. So they really villainize. They take every opportunity they can to divide based on race and mm-hmm. class. But they even included the quote where it was like, this is a structural problem. And it needs to be addressed, like you said, Millie, in a number of ways, from the anti-Asian sentiment to the lack of resources that had them both ended up in that position. That is our show for today. If you know any ways, I will keep an eye out on if Michelle's friends or community have shared ways to support them or her or things that she would have wanted us to support. Definitely let me know. That is our show. We will be back tomorrow. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Elise Ramirez.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow @Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.